I would like to congratulate India on landing on the dark side of the moon. I would also like to now invite India to return the £2.3 billion foreign aid money that we sent them between 2016 and 2021.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that guy really knows his history. Welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 334th, back to India. My name is Dick Newman, and let's get on with it. Made up by the way that I feel. I think these are the words. Yes, the marvellous troops there. We left the East India Company kind of on top of the world. Tons of cash has been extracted from India and sent to England, but we also left it with a warning from our whistleblower, Bolts. Here's his warning once more, because the guy was pretty spot on. The company may be compared to a stupendous edifice suddenly built upon a foundation not previously well examined or secured, inhabited by momentary proprietors and governors, divided by different interests opposed to each other, and who, while one set of them is overloading the superstructure, another is undermining the foundations. Yes, it's pretty spot on. 8th of June 1772, and Scotty banker Alexander Fordyce won't turn up to work. Odd. Bring in the bean counters, and it seems that Alexander Fordyce left behind debts of £550,000. The bank, named Neil James Fordyce and Down, will soon declare bankruptcy. A week later, the Air Bank will close its doors, and they will not be reopening. The following week, and the thing has spread to the duchies, with a number of banks there going to the wall. In the next couple of weeks, 10 banks in Europe are gone. In a month, another 20 banks. These banks are collapsing like dominoes. Oh my God, it's now gone across the Atlantic. Planters have been buying English goods on credit. Easy, because British banks were happy to finance them. But now the goods are coming in and the banks have gone to the wall. The suicide rate in Virginia will rise. Yeah, people are killing themselves over this. Whatever is going on, well, with the colonies, it was about them being overly enthusiastic. They became what was known in my day as fearless borrowers. They wanted more and more capital, and this demand on capital meant more and more guys becoming bankers keen to lend. Keen to lend led to a reduction in what we might call prudential lending. These banks were into speculative lending and competing with each other to lend money. They were taking a punt on loans, and that's gambling, it's not banking. Our Australian banks made a start into speculative lending in the 1990s because they wanted bigger profit, and bigger profit they've got. The respect of the community was a very small price for them to pay. Back to our history, and we have the introduction of venture capitalism. That is, investors who invest in companies in exchange for stock. So rather than being a lender to the company, you become a part owner in it. Guys are borrowing money to be venture capitalists, and that's an unsafe practice, particularly when we are all being so enthusiastic. Back to 1772, and oh, we've got a lot of dodgy loans out there. It will be all fine so long as nobody strikes a match, but here comes our man, Alexander Fordyce, wanker. Yeah, he's a wanker and a banker, who was having a flutter on the East India Company.
All Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa. Doce balanço, caminho do mar.
Sorry about that, if it's not a diggy bird, it's a bloody jet flying over the house. So a wanker banker is having a flutter on the East India Company. He's having a go at shorting the stock. And just to show how he is fair dinkum or stupidly greedy, one of the two, he's in for £300,000. Sir George Colebrook, chairman of the East India Company, will declare bankruptcy personally. That won't give us much confidence in the management of the thing. The Bank of England will intervene to protect the East India Company, but it's under threat itself, that is, the Bank of England. Oh, look, here's a note from Scotty philosopher David Hume, and he is writing to another Scotty philosopher, Adam Smith. We are in a very melancholy situation. Continual bankruptcies, universal loss of credit, and endless suspicions. Do these events anywise affect your theory, or will it occasion the revisal of any chapters of The Wealth of Nations? Now, what happens with our humans who go to India is that the big dicks get very rich. It's a matter then that they need to get their money when they come back to England. The idea is that the company is sending whatever money to England, so then when you're ready to come back, you just send the company a bill. So here we are on the 10th of July 1772, a month after our wanker banker has disappeared, and in comes a packet of bills to the East India Company for £747,195. This seems to be getting a bit out of hand. It's been requests for cash for about £1.5 million over the year from guys who are getting wealthy. Some conservatives think that perhaps we shouldn't pay it just yet. Wait until we can check out what's going on. No way, says a committee. That would be a bad look. We have to pay. Do not forget, my dear listener, that we have famine going on in Bengal. People are not paying rent on their land because they can't. They're not making any income. They haven't grown a crop. What else? Well, we've got lots and lots of overpriced and unsold tea hanging around London warehouses. Over 10 years, we've gone from holding about £1 million worth of stock to holding around about £3 million worth of unsold stock. That is not good. And look, the cost of the military's gone up, and we all voted for a big fat dividend to be paid out to our wealthy shareholders. Have we been prudent managers of this here company? Yes, my dear listener, is no, they have not. They have been fat, greedy pigs eating too many ice fobos. And so it came to pass that the government sent the annual customs bill to the company, and verily the director said, woe, the cupboard is bare, and perhaps we could offer you a blowjob, but the loan repayment to the Bank of England was due, and the director said, woe, the cupboard remains bare, and we have no shingles to offer. But perhaps you, the Bank of England, can loan some to us. The value of the East India Company stock will plummet. They've applied to the Bank of England for a loan of £400,000. 2 weeks later, they will ask for a further £300,000. They've only got £200,000 in cash, with unpaid bills of about £1.6 million, and further obligations, over and above that, of about £9 million. Company assets are valued at £5 million. Dear me. The directors will have a quiet meeting with the government looking for a corporate bailout of £1 million. Don't be stupid, say the government. Read the Adam Smith book, Capitalism Good, Socialism Bad. Have you ever seen us with anything vaguely like a socialist policy? Well, of course not, say the company. Whoever would do anything to help out the common smellies? But this is different. It's corporate socialism. Does the phrase too big to fail mean anything to you guys? Now, my dear listener, our government back then was not as bad as our current governments on this issue. What will happen is, for starters, the government will bag these buggers and call them out for what they are. Irresponsible, fat, greedy pigs. Yeah, well done, government. Then they will do a deal. £40,000 every 2 years in exchange for the company acknowledging that the state has ultimate authority over the Indian territories and a nice big fat loan to get you out of trouble now. The too big to fail thing it is for the government, whether or not they use those words. But you and I might want to look at it a little bit differently. If the East India Company went down, then we would have to do a deal with the Americans instead of doing just whatever we like. Our Indian Empire would have been at risk, but there you go. What difference would it make to ordinary times? Nothing. It will be that last bit that will get the government into action. There is still a ton of money we can get out of India in the future, so sure, let's help the East India Company survive this embarrassing time of liquidity problems. And look, here's yet another bloody economist. They're falling out of the trees, aren't they? They're breeding. This will be Thomas Pownall, who wrote, "People tremble with horror, even at the imagination of the downfall of this Indian part of our system, knowing that it must necessarily involve with its fall the ruin of the edifice of the British Empire." Yeah, no doubt some people are trembling with horror. They're the rich ones. But anyone who thinks about it will be saying, sure, well, but what's in this British Empire for me? Yeah, the answer is bugger all, mate. George will be trembling with horror. He can't bear the thought of anything happening to his beloved empire. Oh, no. He thinks that India will get Britain out of debt. Yeah, well, he could be right there. Parliament will discuss allegations of corruption and malpractice in the company. It will discuss how come the company is broke when so many of its employees are super bloody rich. Parliament will, of course, be helping out with at least 40% of MPs being shareholders. Yeah. 18th of December 1772, our Parliament will have the directors in for a good hard quizzing. Again, totally different to our modern times when our governments just accept that corporate welfare needs to be handed out. Yeah, yeah, you corporations, you need cash from time to time, we know that. No conditions, my darling CEOs, keep paying yourselves bonuses. But no, back in 1772, there will be a fair bit of ripping it up, the directors, and accusations of embezzlement and bribe-taking and corruption, and names will be named. And among the names will be Tall Poppy Robert Clive. Clive responded on the 21st of May 1773 with one of his most famous speeches, saying he objected strongly to being treated like a common sheep stealer. Yeah, no, he steals bloody entire flocks. "After Plassey," he thundered, "our great prince was dependent on my pleasure. An opulent city lay at my mercy. Its richest bankers bid against each other for my smiles. I walked through vaults which were open to me alone, piled on either hand with gold and jewels. Mr. Chairman, at this moment I stand astonished at my own moderation." Yeah, yeah, there you go. Clive will talk for 2 hours. Parliament will talk for a further God knows how long, but well into the night. And Clive, at the end of the day, will be absolved of the charges. Prime Minister North had a loss here. Time to think of something else. "I think, sir, it is allowed that Parliament have a right over the East India Company. Such continual excesses, such frauds at home, oppressions abroad, that all the world might cry out, let it go to the crown." Yeah, he wants to cut the company right out of Bengal and its 20 million mostly very unhappy humans. That will be defeated, of course. Too many MPs have shares to let Bengal go. Besides, those shareholders know the government will bail the company out. Its customs duties alone bring around £900,000 a year into the treasury. At least North will get some regulations in, and Parliament will appoint a Governor-General to represent the government in India. The company was in no position to try any sort of refusal of these items. Marvellous, except companies just do their best to work around regulations, and the company will be rather successful at that. But we are at a time when the government won't just let it go. This is the start of government interference in the company that will eventually nationalise the thing. First Governor-General, I'm happy to report, will be Warren Hastings. I am not happy at all to report that Parliament have also appointed three councillors to oversee Hastings' work. Dick of an idea. The first one of these will be arsehole Philip Francis, Irish guy who is rather devious and will work his dinger off trying to have Hastings out so that he can be the Governor-General. That will mean our eye has been taken off the company, and it will mean that government in India will be a bit stuffed. Another victim in this whole process will be Robert Clive. I've got no sympathy for the guy. He was awful. He got vindicated by Parliament, but he remains guilty in the eyes of the mob. He is now known as Lord Vulture and represents for us all that is bad about the company. Corrupt and unprincipled is Lord Vulture. Clive will piss off France, Italy, and a major breakdown. He'll have stomach pounds and gout. Back to England for his 49th birthday and suicide. He's dead. Cut his throat with a blunt knife. He'd been playing cards with his missus, his secretary, and his secretary's missus. Said he needed to go to the dunny and he might be a while. Eventually, the missus will go to find him, and there he is, dead. She will faint, and there you go. You can be a national hero and super rich, but still not be happy. It is suicide, so a big disgrace. And that will mean a secret midnight burial in an unmarked grave.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please.
Yeah, the movie MASH came out in 1970, making it 53 years old. Terrible. Well, great movie. Oh, he's a jet again. Yeah, somewhere down the coast must have had beer on special, so the jet spin, it's gone. MASH was a marvellous black comedy, which shocked the shit out of us because it was one of the first movies where we got to see blood in a realistic fashion, squirting out of arteries type of thing. Still, didn't we love the anti-war idea of the movie at a time when our government still wanted teenage boys to pop over to Vietnam and kill people we hadn't even met? 19th of October, 1774, a day that will live in infamy. In come the three Crown Councillors to Calcutta, and it will be a 17-gun salute. The three Crown Councillors are totally cracked off that it was not a 21-gun salute. Worse, there's no guards or anybody to show them where they're supposed to go. It'll be even worse when they go to lunch with Warren Hastings, who is in informal clothes. It will be a strongly worded letter of complaint to London. This is a disgrace. But it's worse for Warren Hastings. Having spent time with these three wankers at lunch, he's ready to resign. Not a great start then. It will, of course, be way worse when we get down to business. Why ever did we lend company troops to Shuja-ud-Dula to fight in the Rohilla War? Well, you three not terribly wise men, allow Uncle Dick to field this question, which proves that you've got no fucking idea what's going on. Shuja-ud-Dula is the Nabob of Ud. I say Nabob because you English can't seem to say Nawab, but perhaps this is a deliberate method of showing your contempt for the Indian chappies. Shuja-ud-Dula is an extremely large man whom we defeated in battle and turned him into our puppet Nabob. He was also pals with the Mughal Emperor, the handsome, brave and strong Shah Alam, who we have also turned into a puppet. So, we have got a puppet Mughal Emperor and a puppet Nabob, Shuja-ud-Dula. These guys enable us to make an absolute shit ton of money, like lots and lots and lots of cash. And we want that to go on and on forever and ever. Amen. So in order to protect the future, we have been slowly taking over his forts and putting our hard men in his forts. That way he can't rebel. Now, coming to the point at hand, the Rohilla Afghans have been stuffing around the border, so sure, we sent troops in to see those bloody Afghans off. And there you go. Be wiser and happier, you three wankers. But, ladies and gentlemen, our three wankers are not happy. Oh dear. You have been using troops as mercenaries, and they carried out atrocities on the Afghans. Well, yeah, mercenaries is what the bloody company troops are a lot of the time, mate. It's how the British have got where they are. As for atrocities, well, our government types have never really cared about them much. It's just used as leverage. Hastings wrote of this, "Dark illusions, mysterious insinuations, bitter invective and ironical reflections are weapons to which I've become accustomed." Fair enough, in the game he's in, there's too much money going around for it to be anything other than a nasty game for hard men. Philip Francis, though, will write, "The sweat ran down Hastings' face. Tears gushed from his eyes. He beat his head and ran around the room in a fit of distraction." I don't think so. I don't. Francis will soon be writing to Lord North in London that Hastings is definitely not up to the job. Mr. Hastings is the most corrupt of villains. As for Hastings' only ally on the council, Richard Barwell, he is ignorant, false, presumptuous, and a blockhead. Philip Francis will now look to block everything Hastings is trying to do and reverse everything he has already done. The other couple of councils are army types. They're not terribly bright, and they're happy just to support Francis mostly. Poor old Hastings. He was picked for this job, being pretty much the only guy who wasn't corrupt. His reputation before Philip Francis turned up was just spotless. He was noted for his ability in administration and his ability to churn through the work. Even the Indians liked the guy. He stopped his staff from treating Indians roughly. His pension list included the widow of his first servant and some blind guy who used to sing for him in the streets of Calcutta. He was noted for his struggles with the company to get justice for Indians. May the Almighty bestower of graces and favour reward the Governor for having hastened to the assistance of so many affected families and of listening to the groans and sobs of many thousands of oppressed ones who know how to suffer but cannot speak. Yeah, that was a quote from some Indian guy. Hastings absolutely saw the problem. A corporation running government is a bad, bad idea. Very bad. To hold vast positions and yet act on the level of mere merchants, making immediate gain our first principle, to receive an immense revenue without possessing protective power over the people who pay it. These are paradoxes not to be reconciled, highly injurious to our national character and bordering on inhumanity. Well, yeah, Hastings, the company is not human, so it is actually inhuman. It has no interest in people except for their capacity to be a consumer, or if they're an employee, how to pay them the minimum possible. Hastings has some decent ideas, but implementing them right now with these three turds in place is pushing shit uphill. So Indians who are being abused or oppressed, and that's a lot of them, cannot communicate with their masters, the British, who have no inclination to learn the local language. Thank you. Hastings at least scored a couple of years to make some changes before the three not wise wankers turn up. He will write, "The new government of the company consists of a huge heap of undigested materials, as wild as chaos itself. The powers of the government are undefined. The collection of revenue, the provision of the investment, the administration of justice, if it exists at all, the care of the police are all huddled together, being exercised by the same hands, though most infrequently the two latter officers are totally neglected for the want of knowing where to have recourse to them." Yeah, so he's basically saying, like, our guys can't run a civil society, they just don't know how to do it. Government functions will be moved from Murshidabad to Calcutta, and we will all stop pretending that the Nawab of Bengal has any power. Calcutta is the new capital of Bengal. Hastings, though, doesn't want to give up the Indian systems, so we'll keep on the Indian officials. Good idea. The governor and his councils can replace the Nawab, and then let's just keep going. On that basis, Hastings can focus on other things like unifying the currency, codifying the Hindu and Muslim laws, amazing, reform the tax and custom system, fix land revenue, and at least stop the worst oppression carried out by the private traders. He will create a postal service, get some survey and mapping going, and build some public granaries so we won't have mass deaths with the next famine. Hastings really liked India. He could speak Bengali, Urdu, and Persian. Hastings will make a study of Indian culture, and he likes what he finds. Sir William Jones has been brought out to superintend the new legal system. He's another fan of India. So together, these two guys will form the Asiatic Society and bring in the big-brain Indians so that Hastings can get the real deal story on Indian history and civilization. This will see the first English translation of the Bhagavad Gita, the song by God. So magical stuff, but different magical stuff. It is part of a larger work, the Mahabharata. So the Bhagavad Gita is chapters 23 to 40 of book 6. I think that's how it works. Dangerous rabbit hole here, so let's just skip past it. Hastings, though, has taken the magical stuff seriously and so has picked a verse to be like his motivational whatever thingy to say every day in the mirror. Your entitlement is to the deed alone, never to the results. Yeah, it would have been good to leave it there. Do not make the results of an action your motive. Do not be attached to inaction. Yeah, I don't mind inaction. Having renounced rewards resulting from actions, wise men endowed with discrimination are freed from the bondage of birth and go to the regions of eternal happiness. Yeah, it's a bit long. I'll stick with, the road to success is dotted with many tempting parking spaces. Yeah, that's more me. Philip Francis is more of the Robert Clive school of how to see India, a shithole where we can get some money. The system, though, is three against one, so Hastings is pretty stuffed. Basically, then, nothing much will happen. Indians don't understand it. It all looks a bit stupid to them. Before you know it, the enemies of the company are looking at this too. The company looks divided and therefore weakened, so perhaps testing that weakness would be a good idea. Yeah.
Strange when you're a stranger, faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted, streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, face come out on the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name.
Yeah, the Deep's out there doing a bit of the Doors song. People are strange. Not strange are the Marathas. If you recall, they're very ordinary, what you'd expect. They like to rape, burn, kill, plunder, whatever. You may recall it was they who took advantage of Aurangzeb's stuffing up of the Mughal Empire. The Marathas went a bit Burko, invading, taking and doing lots of killing. They went a bit quiet in 1761. The same year George married Charlotte, but not happy times for the Marathas. They thought they would see off the invading Afghan army. Oddly enough, the Afghan had the Rohilla on their team and Shuja Abdullah on their team. All good buddies at that time. We have no idea of the numbers, but there were lots. The number of dead is also disputed, but let's have a go at 15,000 dead Afghans and 40,000 dead Marathas, with a further 10,000 missing. So a big defeat for the Marathas, and it will be worse. There will be mass executions of non-combatants. 40,000 will die. Then there will be revenge killings against Maratha troops, another 9,000. And then we'll want slaves, so 22,000 women and kiddies will be enslaved. Here's a quote from the time. The unhappy prisoners were paraded in long lines, given a little parched grain and a drink of water, and beheaded. And the women and children who survived were driven off as slaves. 22,000, many of them the highest rank in the land. And all that stuff has kept our Marathas a bit quiet. But you can't keep these buggers down, so they've been slowly gathering strength and taking back control of lands they had lost when totally weakened. They're pretty much good to go, but they're not the only ones. From the south of India, Mysore, we've got Sultan Haider Ali and his son Tipu. Haider's dad was a military type who got to lead 50 men. He continued to be promoted and got to be a general who got a land grant. That made him a big swinging dick owning land, but he will die aged 45 in battle. His son Haider is following in Dad's footsteps, and before you know it, he's leading 100 cavalry and 2,000 infantry. We get the Carnatic Wars, and Haider will be working with the Frenchies and learning lots from them. He was illiterate, but he had a very good memory and was very good with numbers. Haider will find the army in disarray and just take control. The king of Mysore will be very grateful and name him Nawab of Mysore. Then we get civil war. Oh dear. And look who comes out on top. Haider Ali, who is now the king of Mysore. Haider Ali prefers sultan to king. He will expand the Mysore territory, and hey look, the Marathas have just been given that great big kicking, so a good time to sink the boot. Haider Ali has been importing Frenchy military types and Frenchy engineers to improve his military. He even created a navy. Haider Ali is getting a bit older by now, but his son Tipu is just getting going, and he is a guy who will really make the British sit up and take notice. One thing we should all note is that it's not just Haider Ali who has observed the Frenchy methods during the Carnatic Wars. The Indians have had 30 years now of being done over by European techniques, and they have been learning. They are catching up nicely also on the technology, along with the tactics and discipline. The company's response is to try and prevent any European powers from entering the service of Indians, and to try and prevent Indians from using any of our superior weapons. So, pretty stupid plan then. 1767, and we will all find out just how right we were to be worried, because here comes Haider Ali with 50,000 hard men, 23,000 cavalry, and maybe 28,000 infantry. Highly disciplined as sepoy infantry. Oh fuck, say the British, but it is worse. The bangy things are all based on French designs. The artillery have a heavier bore and longer range than ours does. The camel cavalry can fire rockets. Jesus, at our cavalry. Our cavalry have got swords. In they come, and while Haider was coming in, his lad Tipu was leading a daring cavalry raid round the back of Madras. The grand villas were set on fire, and he was rather close to capturing the governor, except his troops, as usual, got a bit distracted at the gift shop. Yeah, all those mansions they were setting on fire had lots of lovely toys in them, so, yeah, well. But the company's in a bit of shock. They haven't seen Indian troops fight like this before, so it'll be the company seeking peace terms. Haider will be bought off, and the Mysore forces go home. But lots of people throughout India, and I'm not talking about European people, but lots of people, will note with some satisfaction that the company can be surprised and defeated. 12 years down the track to 1779, the Bombay Council, without talking to Hastings, will get itself involved with Maratha politics. Idiots. The Marathas had given Raghunath Rao the boot as a Maratha leader. The Bombay Council will say that, hey, we'll put you on the big chair at Pune as the regent to the Kiri Peshwa. Off go some hard men with no authorisation from Calcutta. 2,000 sepoys and a couple of hundred cavalry, some artillery, and 7,000 of Raghunath Rao's cavalry. Leading this lot was Colonel Edgerton, who is rather old. It'll be slow going, very slow, going uphill, making about a mile a day. Then a further 11 days to go just 8 miles of even harder terrain. They're eating all the stores while they're doing this. Anyway, they've got to a destination and can have a nice good look at the Buddha's caves. I say caves because that's what they are, technically, except these things are just amazing. Beautifully carved, but our boys are not here for Buddhism and, well, oh dear. All that time it has taken our lads to climb up to Kaal to see those caves means that the Marathas have had plenty of time to organise a repelling force. So here are our brave lads at Kaal, and they're looking at 50,000 hostile Marathas. Our 2IC, John Carnock, will write back to Bombay saying, this ancient Edgerton wanker is using everything he learned in the military in Germany, and that shit won't fly here, so we're pretty fucked. Well, of course, he was way more polite than me. If we continue as we have hitherto done, moving on slowly from post to post, it is hard to say when the campaign may be at an end, for advantage will be all on their side, the ground being thoroughly broken into gullies and covered with bushes and underwood, where they may find lurking places. The Marathas hover about us, and from the hours of 11 to 3 in the afternoon, play their artillery and rockets upon us. I do not think Colonel Edgerton can hold out much longer. But the Marathas, guys, they're not in a rush. They've got plenty of food, while the British do not have food. The British had walked into a nice trap, a spot where they can now be surrounded. Stragglers will be picked off by snipers. To make it even better, Edgerton is now an unwell colonel. Raghunath Rao was begging them to go on just a bit further. As soon as they get to the outskirts of Pune, his supporters will rise and will have a glorious win. The British, though, have lost their nerve. It will be a midnight chaotic retreat. The Marathas will actually wait till dawn to start the killing. There'll be 350 dead before Edgerton surrenders. And 6 days later, he will sign the Treaty of Wadgaon. Raghunath Rao will be handed over, as will some senior company types as hostages. And a heap of land will be conceded to the Marathas. And so a year later, Nana Pandavis of the Maratha wrote to his old enemy Haydar Ali, saying, hey, Haydar, all that biff between us is in the past. Want to team up and give the British a good kickin'? Maybe we should have Nana's words. They first make sweet promises in such an alluring tone that one is led to believe that the only real faith and honesty in this world are to be found only among them. But it does not take long for one to be undeceived. One quickly realises their evil geniuses. They win over any disconnected member of the state and through him work its ruin. Divide and grab is their main principle. They are so blinded by selfish interests that they never observe written agreements. God alone can fathom their base intrigues. They are bent on subjugating the states of Pune, Nagpur, Mysore and Hyderabad one by one, enlisting the sympathy of one to put down the others. They know best how to destroy Indian cohesion. They are adept at the art of creating insidious differences and destroying the harmony of any state. Oh dear, I think he's got it. The secret's out. The British are not here to be nice guys. Haydar and Tipu are absolutely in. Their reply includes this. The supremacy of the English was a source of evil to all God's creatures. Oh, dear me, is it our turn to be the evil bad guys? Can it be worse for the British? sure can. Louis, 16, might be totally broke, but he can still find some cash to send weapons to Tipu. It's the Frenchies wanting to fight a proxy war again. 17th of July, 1780, and Haydar Ali is on the move with somewhere up to 100,000 hard men and 100 guns. Getting through carefully prepared defensive forces may be tricky if the British had set any up. What the fuck? No troop preparations and no gathering of food and resources have gone not on. No, nothing's happened. At least the company has 30,000 professional troops that can call in and they will come in at a rapid rate. On paper, that is, they've got 30,000 professional troops. Reality reveals they've got 8,000 troops that can come in. Sadly, not all those guys can come in as fast as Haydar's troops. Haydar will move through Harcourt. Oh, that's where the sepoys keep their wives and kiddies. There will be many desertions to go and check on the family. Time to prepare defences. Too late, dickheads. A fucking big army keeps turning up at the places with small garrisons, which immediately run up the white flag. Urgent message to Calcutta. Help wanted. Too fucking late. Tipu is in Calcutta. He has done the surprise motherfucker again. He is into the rich villas around St. Thomas Mount and St. Tome, while Haydar Ali was into land around setting fire to villages and destroying what remained of company food supplies. And the leadership of the whole thing is totally stuffed. Hastings and Francis have not stopped their feud or resolved it. They're still just fighting at the top. Francis continues to block Hastings. Hastings will write back to England. Such has been the tendency and such the manifest spirit of all his actions from the beginning. I judge of his public conduct by my experience of his private, which I found to be void of truth and honour. This is a severe charge, but temperately and deliberately made from the firm persuasion that I owe this justice to the public and to myself as the only redress to both of artifices of which I have been a victim and which threaten to involve their interests with disgrace and ruin. The only redress for a fraud which the law has made no provisions is the exposure of it. Oh, dear me, it's come to a head. 15th of August, 1780, Philip Francis challenged Warren Hastings to a duel. We need leadership, but there you go, it's going to be a duel. Just a little bit of music there from the Ridley Scott first ever movie. I think it was his first ever movie, The Duelist, starring Harvey Keitel, if I recall. Yeah, good stuff at the time. 5:30 a.m. 17th of August at a former house of Mir Jafar. Our old neighbour of Bengal, wasn't he? Hastings got the place now. Do you want to read the letter he left to his missus? I bet you do. So here goes. My heart bleeds to think what your sufferings and feelings must be if ever this letter be delivered into your hands. I shall leave nothing which I regret to lose but you. How much I have loved you and how much beyond all that life can yield. I still love you. He only knows. Do not, my Marion, forget me. Adieu, most beloved of women. My last thoughts will be employed on you. Remember and love me. Once more, farewell. Well, that's a love letter if ever I saw one, but really, the dickhead shouldn't be going off to a duel, should he? He should spend the rest of his life with Marion. He should piss off and live happily ever after. Now, I think we should have a look at this duel, because we can. We've got records of it, and so, well, let's get on with it. I'll be Hastings, eh? Colonel Thomas Pierce, my second, arrived in a carriage to transport us to Belvedere as arranged. We arrived exactly at the proposed time, 5:30 a.m. Mr. Francis and his second, Colonel Watson, were seen walking down the road. Some time was consumed looking for a private place. Our seconds proposed that we should stand at a measured distance, fixed at 14 paces. Colonel Watson paced and marked, then stood to the southwards. There was, I recollect, no wind. Our seconds proposed that no advantage should be taken, but each of us should choose his own time to fire. Ah, Colonel Thomas Pierce here to explain what happened next. What? It soon became clear that both of these gentlemen were unacquainted with the modes usually observed on these occasions. Indeed, neither of the two most powerful British intellectuals in Bengal seemed entirely clear as to how to operate their pistol. By Jove! Francis said he had never fired one in his life, while Hastings thought he remembered firing one once. Watson and I loaded the weapons for them and showed them the trigger. Hastings, ever the gentleman, decided to let Mr. Francis fire first. Mr. Francis took aim and squeezed the trigger. The hammer snapped, but the pistol misfired. Again Mr. Francis's second had to intervene, putting fresh priming in the pistol and chapping the flints. Hastings still proposed to receive fire. Mr. Francis aimed twice and withdrew his pistol. Finally, Mr. Francis drew his trigger, but his powder was damp, and so his pistol did not fire. Hastings came down from his present to give Mr. Francis time to rectify his priming, which was done from a cartridge with which I supplied him, finding they had no spare powder. Again the gentlemen took their stands and both presented together. Yes, Colonel Pierce, let me get to the nub of the matter. I now thought I judged that I might seriously take my aim at him. I did so, and when I thought I had fixed the true direction, I fired. His pistol went off at the same time, and so near the same instant that I'm not certain which was first, but believe mine was, and that his followed in the instant. He staggered immediately, his face expressed sensation of being struck, and his limbs shortly, but gradually, went under him, and he fell, saying, but not loudly, "I am dead." I ran to him, shocked at the information, and I can safely say without any immediate sensation of joy for my own success. The seconds also ran to his assistance. I saw his coat pierced on the right side, and feared the ball had passed through him. But he sat up with much difficulty several times, and once attempted with our help to stand. But his limbs failed him, and he sank to the ground. Colonel Watson then proposed that as we had met from a point of honour and not for personal rancour, we should join hands, or that Mr. F. should give me his. We did so. Mr. F. cheerfully, and I expressed my regret at the condition to which I saw him reduced. He found most ease lying on his back. A cot was brought from Major Tolley's, he having no pannikin, and he was conveyed upon it to Belvedere, where he remains. Colonel Pierce and I returned to our house in town. We went to seek Dr. Campbell, and I desired Dr. Francis, Hastings' personal physician, to follow. Both immediately went. They found the wound not dangerous, having entered the side before the seam of the waistcoat, a little below the shoulder, and passing through both muscles within the skin, which covers the backbone, and was lodged within visible distance of the skin in the opposite side. As soon as I returned home, I sent Mr. Markham to Sir Elijah Impey, the Chief Justice, to inform him of what had passed, and that I should wait the event, which, if fatal, I should instantly surrender myself to him, that the law may take its course against me. Yeah, no need, mate. The doctor popped that ball out, saying the wound is of no consequence. 10 days later, the company troops are on the march, led by Sir Hector Munro, who surprised everybody, including himself, 15 years ago when he defeated Shuja-ud-Dula at Buxar. This time, though, he has 5,000 sepoys who are not very happy, have been paid well, and then marching towards an army of 100,000. Oh, my Gilead. But hang on, there's a second force under Scotty Colonel William Bailey, who has 2,800 sepoys, plus a couple of hundred Scotties. That makes, let's see, 100,000 versus, oh yeah, we are fucked. These 100,000 are not your old-school runaway-type Indians. They are trained and disciplined. Any description of that army? Yep. It is like waves on an angry sea with a trail of artillery that has no end. Munro then will wait for Bailey. No, he won't. He's impatient. And the word is out that there are provisions and plenty of ammo at Kanchapuram. And Munro wants it before Haydar can get it. Just one more day would have allowed the two forces to join up, but no, it's not going to happen. Bailey will camp on the bank of a small river, the Coralaya. That night, the monsoon will start, and we get heavy rain for 12 hours. At first light, that small river can now be seen to be a raging torrent. It will be 11 days before Bailey can cross it, and in that time, Tipu has moved between the two forces with 11,000 top cavalry. Oh dear. So Biff will kick off with long-range artillery. Yeah, it's coming in, not going out. Bailey's mob were caught in the open. They're knee-deep in rice fields and dying in the heavy drizzle. Neither side, though, are starting close combat, and both have sent for reinforcements. No worries, kiddos, says Haydar. Have a heap of guys. Yeah, nah, sorry, says Munro. I've nicely fortified the temple at Kanchapuram, and they will be having a very hard time getting me out. You're on your own, lad. Oh, no, hang on, look. If I do that, then they'll speak badly about me in future podcasts. Here, look, have 1,000 sepoys with some ammo. They can lead you to the temple in safety. That 1,000 sepoys will do a midnight runner on their horses and manage to only just avoid Tipu's guys. And we can say, well done, lads. They get to Bailey and give him the news and say, sir, sir, we must get going while it's still dark, sir. Now, sir. No way, says Bailey, we aren't going anywhere till I've had me porridge for breakfast. Idiot. So they will set off at dawn straight into an ambush. That delay had allowed Tipu's guys to report the direction the 1,000 guys had taken. So easy to set up an ambush. There they are then in a village with enemy troops and artillery in front and artillery on the left with muddy paddy fields on both sides and a river on their right and pretty bloody well stuffed. Form a square. Plenty of cannon shot coming in and Bailey is wounded. His leg is out of action, but he can still yell out orders. But there's going to be this kind of weird halt in the bombardment, and it's all gone quiet. That's going to last for about 30 minutes. Then we get to hear a noise in the distance. It's the sound of an army. I mean, all we can see is dust, but we can hear it's coming. But now it's starting to come into view, and we can see long lines of scarlet columns marching steadily towards us. And it must be Munro. Oh, huzzah, huzzah. Hang on, as it comes closer, we can now see, fuck, it's Haydar and his whatever 100,000 hard men, and we are well and truly stuffed. Haydar will just send in his guns, about 50 of them, and start pounding away. There will be the odd pause of guns to allow a cavalry charge. The British will repel 13 charges in an hour. Haydar is getting bored, so they bring in the really big guns, and now we've got grape shot coming in. Eventually, a shot will hit the British ammunition for a very big bang, so in come the cavalry, and that includes elephants. Up goes the white flag. Yeah, nah, say the enemy cavalry, and start killing guys who have put down their weapons. This is now a massacre. The Indians are repaying for, whatever, 30, 40 years or something of British nastiness. It's not going well for the British. Such as were saved from immediate death were so crowded together that it was only with difficulty they could stand. Several were in a state of suffocation, while others, from the weight of the dead bodies that had fallen upon them, were fixed to the spot and therefore at the mercy of the enemy. Some were trampled under the feet of the elephants, camels, and horses, and those who were stripped of their clothing lay exposed to the scorching sun without water and died a lingering and miserable death, becoming the prey to ravenous wild animals. 36 officers dead, 34 officers wounded and prisoners, 16 amazingly not wounded and prisoners. So the officer class actually did well again. Bailey will be losing his leg and has a wound to his back and his head. About 200 sepoys will be prisoners with the rest, with about 3,800 dead. You know, I said the officer class did well, but perhaps they aren't the right words. Let's hear from one of the guys. They began by pulling the buttons of my coat, which they took for the silver. Then they tore the knee buckles out of my breeches and the coat off my back. One put the butt end of his firelock to the back of my neck and pinned me to the ground with it while another tried to pull off my boots. He got one off with difficulty and enraged, I suppose, at not being able to pull off the other. He gave me a cut on my right thigh that laid it open to the bone. Shortly after, another fella passing by wantonly thrust his sword into my other thigh. After they were gone, one of Haydar's sepoys, perceiving that I still lived, raised me up and placed me against a tree and gave me some water to drink. Now this guy will go on to tell us how it's all going to get worse. Our leader Bailey will die in captivity, as will more. Munro will get his mob back to Madras, and the people will lay the blame on him for the disaster. He will be jeered and hooted over the Battle of Pollilure, the severest blow the English have had in India. Worse, because Tipu is not finished yet. 7,000 prisoners will be taken overall. 300 of these guys will find themselves circumcised and learning how to be a Muslim. 1 in 5 of all British soldiers in India will find themselves in a Tipu slammer. Drummer boys will be dressed as girls and taught to dance like dancing girls. One of these will eventually be liberated and, oh no, the horror, this little kid prefers to be Indian and no longer wants to be British. That's our culture being taken, dear me. In all this, the English have learned what it's like to be beaten and humiliated, so surely they will now show compassion to the Indians. Of course not.
Just a little bit of Lexi Ross there covering the Metallica song Unforgiven.
Well, as I said, we have to revitalize the Palestinian Authority, which means giving the support necessary for good governance, understanding that on the issues that must be resolved as we think of a plan for the day after, it is about good governance, which will bring transparency and accountability to the people of Gaza and the West Bank. It's also about what we need to do to recognize there must be some plan for security for the region. And I suspect as a plan develops, it will take into account interim and then longer term.
Yes, I got that instead of historical fiction this week because I am still on my epic novel about King Steve and Empress Matilda. She's just taken over as Lady of England, but yeah, she's not doing a good job of it, really, I have to say. But there you go, the US plan to whatever in Gaza. I think you, my dear listener, might have come up with stuff like food, water and medical attention, but the Americans are offering buzzwords. Marvellous stuff. So it's just a matter of what we go out with. This week we might go out with a bit of the Velvet Underground and Oh Sweet Nothing. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Say a word for G. Jimmy Brown. He ain't got nothing at home. Not the shirt right off his back. He ain't got nothing at home. And say a word for Ginger Brown. Walks with his head down to the ground. Took the shoes right off.